Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We've got a great show today on cannabis. Yes, we're talking cannabis, so tune in and learn something. You'll be surprised at the information we're going to share this evening. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through the blocks and release the energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release your BS that is holding you back. But you know, I always ask the question, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I am a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, the Men and Money book, and, Masterful Choice is the Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life to the absolute fullest. Now, my clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living in human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, visit my website, MoniqueChapman.com. I invite you to like me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. You can also sign up for my opt-in newsletter, Intuitive Living. And again, that's from my website, MoniqueChapman.com. Now, my guest tonight, his name is Will Johnson. He is the author of Cannabis in Spiritual Practice, The Ecstasy of Shiva, The Calm of Buddha. Now, Will Johnson is a teacher of embodied spirituality and meditation. A graduate of Princeton University, he is the founder of the Institute of Embodiment Training in Costa Rica and teaching school that views the body as the doorway, not the obstacle, to real spiritual growth and transformation. He's the author of a number of books about the role of the body in Buddhist meditation and in the poetry of the Sufi mystic Rumi. An early student of the somatic teacher Ida Ralph, he teaches at his center in Costa Rica as well as at Buddhist centers around the world. And you can check him out and more information about him out at the website, and that is www, of course, embodiment.net, embodiment.net. Welcome, Will.
Hi, nice to be here, Monique.
Hi, it's great to have you here all the way from Costa Rica. Folks, we had a journey getting it together, but we got it together. So, you know, if it's meant to be, it does happen. So I am so glad that you have joined me, Will. I've wanted to talk about cannabis on the show for a very long time. And actually, you're the first author who wrote a book about cannabis, who's willing to come on air and talk about it. It's like, go figure. You put a book out there, you'd think you'd want to promote it. But thank goodness for you. Thank the universe for you. Now, The title of your book, Cannabis and Spiritual Practice, The Ecstasy of Shiva and the Calm of Buddha. Now, while I was reading the book, I discovered that you are a pretty strong Buddhist. You're following that practice, but yet and still you utilize cannabis. What's up with that?
Yeah, interesting question. And now, definitely, I would be considered something of an outlier and an anomaly in the Buddhist world with my with respect to my openness to entheogenic substances and obviously substances like cannabis. Now, what gets very interesting about that, I like both practices. I like them very much. Uh-huh. In the Buddhist world, I teach as a traditional Buddhist teacher following all the precepts, one of which says don't use any kind of mind-altering or intoxicating substances. And I do that within the Buddhist world because the kinds of practices that we're exploring in the Buddhist world work much better without a substance like cannabis, because they're about focusing the mind. You focus the mind on an object, you lose your attention, it wanders off in thought, you bring it back. So you're focusing, losing, recalibrating. With the Shiva practices, why cannabis works for them is that they're less about focusing and refocusing than they are about awakening the energies of the body and just surrendering to the currents that get liberated. So for me, I love the Buddhist practices. They do something extraordinary and unique. But also for me, all my life, I have been a cannabis user exploring some of these other practices in conjunction, perhaps as a balance to the Buddhist practices that I also teach.
Okay. Well, I want to back up a little bit, and I want you to share with the audience. You had, in your book, you talk about meeting, going to some type of either church service or seminar and talking to a minister, and you gave a presentation, and you thought it was going to be because you the minister wanted to talk to you, and you thought it was going to be because perhaps you went too far with what you were sharing, but it turned out to be just the opposite. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's where actually, in many ways, my motivation that it's probably around time to write this book started from. I had been invited out to the East Coast to be the sermonizer for the day at a Unitarian church, very open, wonderful people. And it was more of an interaction with the congregation than a traditional sermon. So I led them through different experiential exercises in and of themselves and with other people. It was really high. It was just great. So the minister came up. I wanted to talk to you the next day. He was really fascinated. What were the practices that I was doing that had led me to be able to do what we'd done in his church the day before? And, you know, we talked about that. An hour into the conversation, the conversation turned on a dime. And he said, now I have to ask you to use cannabis in conjunction with any of these practices. Now, as I said in the book, I hadn't been expecting that. But he was very open, wanted to know. And much as I just spoke of, I told him that, yeah, some of the practices that I do, no, cannabis doesn't work that well for, but many of these extraordinary, more Shiva-oriented practices, cannabis not only works well, but can almost be viewed as an integral component of the practice. So a very, very fascinating conversation ensued. And as he said in the end, he said, you know, we need this information. You know, the prohibition has stifled any kind of sharing of, well, what can you do if you want to use these substances to get closer to, in his, you know, in his context, closer to God or whatever word works for you, you know, to open to the higher self, what you're talking about in your wonderful introduction, to break down and break through the barriers that are keeping, you know, the fullest expression of what we are as human being inhibited. So in many ways, that's when it started. And over the years, and really in the last number of years, as it feels like there has now been a significant cultural shift with people's acceptance of and openness to something like cannabis, it felt certainly timely that for those of us for whom cannabis works, if we also are interested in specific, intentional practices that can really take us high into some extraordinarily open and dissolved birthright states, here are some of those practices and here's what you can do. So that it was a wonderful book to write, and I would have felt cowardly if I hadn't written it at this point.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad that you decided to step out and write it. Now, you just said that for those of us where cannabis works, whom cannabis works for, you mean cannabis doesn't work for everybody? It doesn't have an effect?
It has an effect for everybody, but just like any substance, some substances work better for some people than for others. Now, the vast majority of people who are cannabis users, it works well for. There are probably some people who get you know, a relationship with the herb that can put them more to sleep than make them more awake. It can become addictive. It's like that with alcohol. It's like that with any of the drugs. In the teaching that I do, I want people to take responsibility for themselves. If a substance like cannabis works for you, bring it into your life. If it no longer works for you, let it go. If it's never worked for you, don't get involved. Although, you know, it's interesting, Monique, what I have also viewed over the years, both in and out of the spiritual world, people for whom cannabis works well, they bring it into their lives. It works in so many different ways. It's a wonderful, supportive substance for their spiritual opening. Don't really care if other people use it or not. Sometimes what I encounter, especially in the spiritual world, is that people who don't use cannabis don't think that anybody else should either. And, you know, that's, you know, to me, an imbalance. I like both paths. I don't want one path telling the other path what to do. I don't tell my Buddhist students, oh, you should start using cannabis. That's not for me to make that decision. But I don't, as a Buddhist teacher, I couldn't tell a follower of Shiva, oh, don't use cannabis. I mean, it just doesn't add up.
Okay, so you kind of let your students have free will with what they're willing to do and how far they're willing to go with it, and I think that's a sign of a great teacher. Now, something I read in a book, and it really shocked me. It's like I read it three times before moving
okay,
on.
Okay, tell me.
And that was that cannabis is Shiva's favorite herb, and that Shiva enjoyed drinking bang.
Well, you know, when you get that story, you have that kind of response. So here is the great Hindu god Shiva. In the Hindu cosmology, there is Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Those are the three great gods. And here, the story of Shiva that has been passed down to the present day is quite an extraordinary story. And now I have no idea about Brahma and Vishnu. I'm pretty sure they're mythical beings. Many people view Shiva as a mythical being. I don't think entirely that that's so. I think he was a real flesh and blood human because his story is all too human. And I think he was a regular human guy, but obviously an extraordinarily high and open being on whom eventually a lot of mythic dazzle would get projected. But his story is that he fell in love with a daughter of high princely society, wooed and wanted to wed her. They came together, a very, very high couple. They drank down, this is the legend, down to the present day, they would drink bhang together, which is a drink that's infused with cannabis leaves. And what Shiva said would happen to him is that once he drank bhang and started feeling the effects of the cannabis, his body would start making spontaneous movements. And out of these spontaneous movements, it is said that he brought the practices of yoga, hatha yoga, and dance to the planet. Now, I have spoken to so many people, and I can just share from my experience when I was a younger guy, that's what happened to me. I started getting into my body, awakening my body, and then one day I smoked, and I was down in the garden, and the next thing I knew, I was feeling an extraordinary opening in the feeling presence, the energies, the buzzing, the vibratory sense of my body, and then these energies just started moving the body. Now, I was not a dancer, you know, I was just a typical guy. You know, I kind of bob up and down a little bit at rock and roll shows, but that was the extent of it. And all of a sudden, my body is moving. And I just let it happen. And that really did open up and usher in a whole chapter of my life that I've, you know, continued to explore. So these practices of Shiva, and I've talked to so many young people who've had openings dancing all night long at raves, you know, for example. But all of a sudden the body is moving, you know, perhaps on cannabis in their life. They're not making those movements, but it feels extraordinarily natural and healing to allow them. So yes, this use of cannabis that we're talking about in the practices in this book derives or goes back directly to the great Hindu god Shiva.
Hmm. Very interesting, because when I read that, I was just floored. And, I mean, it made sense afterwards, but it's just, you know, you're thinking along a certain line of thought, okay? And then all of a sudden, yeah, something else is new is thrown in there. And it allows you to think for a moment, and then you can accept or reject. And I definitely accepted what you had to say about it. And it seems like the Indian community has definitely accepted what you're saying. I have a lot of Indian neighbors who are very spiritual, and I actually spoke to them, uh-huh, and shared your book with some of them, and they validated, uh-huh, what you're saying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not that I, yeah, needed them to validate, but I just wanted to know, you know, from their standpoint, being here in the United States and maybe not connected to traditional ways, but there's something definitely there. Now, you talked about Hatha Yoga. How does cannabis assist us with Hatha Yoga? And maybe you want to explain what Hatha Yoga is in case there's someone listening who's not familiar.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, well, Hatha Yoga is the form of yoga that is the form that's the most popular and is being spread the most in the United States. And it involves doing physical postures and stretches, what are called asanas. So it's a very deeply body-oriented practice. Now, cannabis, in support of spiritual practices, is useful whenever those practices are about awakening and opening the body. And what I mean by that is opening the feeling presence on the body, and every part of the body down to the smallest cell, there are these little pinprick blips of shimmering kinds of sensations. And uh-huh, they exist on every part of the body, but within our culture, we're so lost in thought most of the time, we block out our awareness of this rich and loamy soil of feeling presence. So Hatha Yoga works to awaken feeling presence. Cannabis, in the context of spiritual practice, works to awaken feeling presence. So anything, and I've said this in the book, that you do skiing, skateboarding, snowboarding, running, Pilates, to people, if they are drawn to this, I don't recommend that people do anything. I want people to take responsibility for whether they make a decision to do something like this or not. Because it's important. Everybody has to take responsibility for themselves. But I know of many people who are doing Hatha Yoga that take some of Shiva's sacrament before they start doing their practices. Now, my wife, when she was a young woman, lived for 16 years in India. And she would spend time up in the foothills of the Himalayas. Her yoga teacher training was 4 months of intensive training in Varanasi and then 4 months to go up into the Himalayas and to retreat. Uh-huh. And during that time, she lived in an area where there were a lot of wandering Shiva sadhus. These were austere yogis who were following Shiva's path. And they would sometimes show up in the middle of the night and take refuge on her porch. They'd wake up in the morning. They were always very respectful to her, invited her to join in with them, with their yoga practices. And they would, quote unquote, invoke Shiva before they entered into their Hatha yoga practices by lighting what was called a chillum, a pipe in India, and passing it around. And the ingestion of the cannabis was the way they invoked Shiva, because it started waking their body up. They started feeling these waves of surging sensation starting to be liberated through the body, letting go, breaking down, and breaking through. Those are your words, Monique. I just like those so much. The holding that we have, the inhibition that we have, and very much so within our culture, to let go and let these strong, extraordinary, wonderful feeling energies awaken again and start moving through. So many people, the majority probably of people who do Hatha Yoga, don't use cannabis, but increasingly there may be some people who are drawn to experiment with that if they're people who have cannabis in their life. What I don't want anymore is the injunction, this spiritual attitude and injunction that says, don't do that. That's bad. And Yeah, you know, it is a surprise when we hear the story of Shiva, because we've been led to think, oh, the idea of spiritual practice, I would never use anything like a mind-altering and theogenic substance. And I think it's time for that attitude to be called on for what it is. It's time to let it go. The important thing to do is take responsibility for what works in your life and what doesn't, and then learn how to work with your decision and make it work for you, and not criticize anybody else for making different choices.
Yeah, that's it. The criticism for the different choices, the judgment, it seems to be pervasive in society today.
Yeah.
Unfortunate. Well, how do we get past, though, looking down our nose and judging for someone for doing what they feel is right for them?
Yeah. I mean that's the, that's the big question. But as you said, you want to cut through the BS. Now, it's interesting because I loved what you said. BS stands for belief system. You know,
and
it's our belief system. Yeah, and bullshit. And bullshit. That's what I was getting at, because the way to break down the division with people is to realize I have a belief system that may not agree with your belief system, but it's imperative on me, as much as it's difficult for me to get this, that your belief system isn't bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very challenging one. But, somehow we all, and I think of the United States, we've got to come together again. We've got to come together as brothers and sisters that love each other rather than get into these tribal camps that are sending thought arrows at each other.
Yeah, well, it's really difficult here in the United States.
Difficult.
This podcast is being recorded before the midterm election, and on Blog Talk Radio, it will air after the midterms. But it's really kind of frightening on all sides as to, what's going on. We've lost honor.
And we've lost honor.
Our sense of self.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. I wish cannabis would bring that back. I'd send a crap load to the White House, but
I have sometimes thought that, this wave has happened. Canada just legalized this week, and I'm cynical enough to believe that within 5 years, many Western countries will legalize, not necessarily because politicians will say, well, the mores have changed and we want to honor our citizens' wishes. It's just because they're going to see how much money is raised on the taxes and goes into the coffers. If that's what it takes, hallelujah. But I vision a time 50 years from now, and this is simply my bias and my BS, my belief system, but I look to the time, I think it'll be a far more interesting political culture when many or most of the politicians there are cannabis users, perhaps more than alcohol drinkers. That could be very interesting as well.
It will be, and I won't be around to see it due to my current age, but I can look down from above.
Yeah, I never thought I was going to live to see the day that something like what's happened in California, Washington, Colorado, Oregon, all across the United States. I'm a Canadian citizen, Canada, the whole of the country, just legalized. I never thought I was going to live to see this day. So we may be surprised. This could happen more quickly than we realize. And I think as a parallel example, what happened with the Berlin Wall, that looked like something that was going to last for centuries, and it came down in a matter of days or weeks. Mm-hmm. So let's just see. We can always be hopeful.
Yes, we can. Well, folks, we're speaking with Will Johnson. He's the author of Cannabis and Spiritual Practice, The Ecstasy of Shiva, The Calm of Buddha. You can check him out at his website, and that's embodiment.net. Again, that's embodiment.net. Now, Will, a few moments ago we were talking about, Shiva and ecstasy and the dance and the movement, but what if someone's handicapped and they want to utilize cannabis? How can they shift that energy of, you will, because they literally cannot get up and dance.
Yeah. So for, someone who has some kind of physical impairment, they can still enjoy cannabis for probably relaxing through the body. And, you know, unless someone is, you know, truly a paraplegic or had a stroke, there was this extraordinary movie, what was it, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, of someone who was completely immobile but still very, very awake. So, you know, obviously that's a situation that they're not going to be able to follow the practices that I'm talking about. But I remember back when I used to live in Canada, my wife and I lived on Vancouver Island, about an hour's drive north of Victoria. And I used to go down, we would go down sometimes to Victoria. They would have every Friday night something called a One Heart Dance. This is in the 90s. You know, every major city has, you know something like this that goes on. Just music's put on, and it's everybody letting go and ecstatic dancing. And sometimes, when I would be there, I'd kind of, you know, wander around and just enjoy the energies of everybody. Very mm-hmm. pure, very people playfully interacting with energies. And there was one of my favorite people that I would spend a lot of time dancing with was a young Native woman in a wheelchair. And she was there, and you could see she had very limited mobility in her body, but she was still kind of shaking it and moving it within the limited range of motion that she had. And there would be many, many times that I would just stand right in front of her, and we would play, and it was very cool and very, very high. So, you know, obviously, what I'm talking about is for the fortunate mm-hmm. Majority of, people who can still, you know, have the faculties to explore a deeply body-oriented practice. However, for someone who's even a paraplegic, and I've met people like that as well, what cannabis can do is take them through the sensations of their body. Maybe there won't be a lot of motion, but they too can use it as a tool to reawaken this global sense of the entire body as a unified field of very shimmery, feeling presence. So, you know, we do what we do within the limitations or the opportunities that we have.
Okay. Very well said. Now, in the book, Cannabis and Spiritual Practice, you talk about the five precepts. Could you talk to our audience about them?
Yeah, and it's interesting. One of the things that I, you know, wanted to do with the precepts, because that's where all of Buddhist practice is based, you know, the moral foundations, that you have to have certain ethical values in your life, that, you know, create a foundation that's going to really help you build a house of spiritual practice. So the five precepts in the Buddhist world, and it's interesting, they're mostly always couched in negative terms. Don't harm living things. Don't take what isn't given. Don't engage in sexual misconduct. Don't lie, and don't take intoxicants. Now, Shiva, if you just heard a sound in the background, that was an iguana running down the roof.
Oh,
I don't know if that
okay. Well, we got iguana spirit energy with us. Okay.
Yeah. They're extraordinary little animals. Mm-hmm. So anyway, look, that sounded like the iguana from Urion.
That was more like cell phone getting a text message, but okay.
So, you know, the Shiva practice is you want to have these foundational ethical support. I mean, that's what makes the practices work. If you start contravening them, it actually contravenes the practices, because the practices are about opening and letting go. And if you harm living things, take what isn't given, engage in sexual misconduct, lie, you're going to tighten the body. But what I'm interested in, what I did with the book, is also translate those five fundamental Buddhist precepts from negative language into a more positive language. So in a sense, not to be treated as children told not to do this, not to do that, but as adults, you know, are committed to taking responsibility for ourselves and our own evolution. So instead of don't harm living things, I say it's time for us to honor life. And within the context of the Shiva practices, of course, it's honoring everyone, It's honoring everyone, but it's honoring the life force, this way, this somatic presence, this feeling presence, the life force that wants to awaken in us. We want to, it's literally a feeling, a flow of energy. So we want to honor that. Be generous in all ways with others. It's not just don't take given, but give. There's an old, I believe it's a Hindu statement that everything's not given is lost. We just keep giving ourselves because that's what happens when the awakened body starts radiating. It just starts radiating, and it gives of itself. Be clean in your sexuality. The sexual energies are so potent, you know, nobody gets a free pass. We have to figure them out. There are no rules of what's right or what's wrong. You have to figure out what works for yourself.
But what do you mean by be clean?
If you have agreements of fidelity with another partner, any kind of extra relationship stuff that's done behind other people's back, I've been there. Most people have been there, either on the giving or receiving end. It's horrible. You can't do these kinds of practices. On the other end of the extreme, imposing celibacy on a young person for any kind of religious reason is a kind of sexual misconduct. Women, they may be attracted to men. Women may be attracted to other women. We may be drawn to have one partner through our life, or multiple partners at the same time, or one partner at a time. Or maybe we are naturally just more comfortable in our own, in our own skin. We have to figure this out. And obviously, sexual violence is huge sexual misconduct. So that would be the most unclean, you know, imposing one's sexual will on another person who is not open to that. We could have a whole other show about that, but people don't go there, right?
Okay.
So, and then with, it's telling the truth. Mean what you say, say what you mean, speak with truth as much as possible. So it's only when we get to the fifth precept, the one that in the Buddhist world says don't take intoxicants, because intoxicants don't work if you're doing a practice about focusing your mind, concentrating it, becoming sharply aware. Oop, I went off in a thought. Ah, refocus, recalibrate, bring it back. Cannabis doesn't work. Alcohol doesn't work. Different substances don't, work for that. But I have retranslated that in a Shiva context, the precept of put into your body only what feeds and nourishes your body and soul, and you have to be the one to make the decision of what that is. It may have to do with the kind of food you're eating, and certainly within the context of what we're talking about today and in the book that I wrote, it has to do, does something like cannabis, does something like some of the stronger entheogenic substances, does that help? Does that nourish my body, feed and nourish my body and soul? Or does it not? If it does, it would actually be, in a sense, unethical not to do it. Just as it is, it would be, in a sense, unethical for a Buddhist who believed he or she is a Buddhist, I'm following this path, I'm following these precepts, that's all it is. It would be a violation of the precepts to take something like cannabis. For a follower of Shiva who would agree with the first four precepts, it would, I believe, be unethical not to take the sacrament that Shiva used to, with his practices. If you're wanting to open to that, I've said in the past or in the book, if you want to know what Buddha knew, you have to do what Buddha did. If you want to know what Shiva knew, you have to do what Shiva did. Ultimately, and I know I'm saying this till I'm blue in the face, it's about taking responsibility for ourselves.
that is your mantra, and it's a much-needed mantra. Now, in the book, you talk about this wonderful practice of gazing. And right. How does, the gazing, looking into another's eye for a period of time, how do you incorporate cannabis in this, and what is the outcome?
Yeah. The gazing practice is an extraordinary practice. Just a bit of background on this. I literally stumbled upon the practice in my early 20s when... talk about everything happens that's supposed to happen. I got picked up hitchhiking by an older man, and we just ended up becoming extraordinary friends. It was a friendship. It wasn't a sexual love affair at all. It was an extraordinary friendship between two men, and we were using cannabis in our explorations. The common question was, what would it be to act in an authentic way? And what do I have to break through and break down? What is holding me back from that? And one day, at the end of a long, extraordinary day of practices together, we're sitting at opposite ends of the couch, and we looked at each other, we held each other's gaze. I came across this practice totally by luck. Mm-hmm. And we held each other's gaze for a moment, and then we both looked away. You know, eye contact in our culture, most people don't do it. Most people are uncomfortable with it. Most people don't want that. Mm-hmm. And we turned away, but we both felt something. And Phil, my friend, said, "Hey, what just happened there?" I said, "Yeah, I guess I looked away. I guess I was feeling, the sensations became too strong." He said, "Yeah, that happened to me too. What's wrong with that?" And I am down on my hands and knees thanking him for that till the last breath that I exhale, because we said nothing. We turned to each other. We entered into what I came to understand many, many years later is this extraordinary gazing practice that the Sufi mystic poet and developer, the originator of the Dance of the Whirling Dervish, Rumi, got into in a very, very big way with his spiritual partner, Shams of Tabriz. We sat, we held each other's gaze, and over the next hour, it's difficult really to recount what starts happening. Body comes alive in a way that is sometimes stronger than you've ever felt. You get in touch deeper and deeper and deeper layers of what is truly who and what you are. Different kinds of sensations can start coming up to the surface, like a parade of healing, different kinds of holding. There was a scared little boy that came up and released. There was a wise old being that came in. You morph, you change. And visually, things can get extremely unusual. The hard edges of your friend's face can soften. You can see different colors, different lights around them. Sometimes their face may disappear, and there can come a time if your partner is truly someone that you can open to at the deepest levels of friendship. You know, it's like two objects getting caught in a whirlpool that takes you down into this common center, what I call, the great wide open. Rumi calls it the consciousness union. Buddhists call it the open mention of being the way, the state. You can enter into that together in such a way that there's almost no more distinction between you and your partner. It is an extraordinary practice. It is deeply body-oriented. It accentuates feeling awareness of the body only than anything I know. And as I was saying, early practices that are about accentuates the body. Things like cannabis can be an extraordinary catalyst for. Now, there is no evidence that Rumi and Shams used cannabis for this, and I taught this practice a lot in the 19 when I would teach it. It was in the context of workshops and retreats at different centers, and we would never use cannabis. You do not need cannabis to enter into this practice and have an extraordinary. Having said that, it is one of the practices for which cannabis can be a very, very powerful catalyst for.
Okay. Now, last but not least, before we go, I want you to talk to us about the power of music, of singing, especially the notes of the scale the utilization. I'll get that out of cannabis.
Yeah. Well, cannabis and music are very comfortable bedfellows. Mm-hmm. And, for those of us that go to shows and listen to music, to the musicians on stage, to humming, in the shower, singing has a long tradition of being related to cannabis. I lived and studied with a North Indian veena player in San Francisco for a couple of years in San Francisco in the early 1970s, an extraordinary time. He was someone who came out of a background of using, cannabis when he was the court musician to a Maharaja. So, and it's interesting, I didn't really smoke cannabis with him, but the implication was it was there. To learn the different scales, we would sing the scales. And even though I don't play that instrument, music is still a very important part of my life. I play guitar in a very open tuning, like a North Indian stringed instrument. But opening one's voice, learning the notes of the scale, and I talk about an electronic tambour. I wish I had it here with me. You turn it on, it gives this drone. It's a thing, and over there, the scales. You can learn the scales and then you can just start playing around. Now, what just came out of my mouth there is nothing that I've ever done. It's just you let go, just like you let go with the body, and it makes spontaneous movements and sound can come out. There's a whole world of toning. It's a very, very powerful practice of opening the body. What I love about using cannabis in conjunction with opening to these specific scales of the Indian system, the Greek system, seeing these scales, there's something about the notes in conjunction with the drone instrument that immediately grounds you into that extraordinarily centered place within your body. So hence, once again, cannabis can be used as a support for, in some ways, freeing you of your inhibitions. You know, how many people have been told when they were young, oh, you don't have a good voice, oh, you don't sing. This is a wonderful practice to break through and break down that BS.
Okay.
Right? Yes. Everybody can, just open your voice and, play with the scales. Just find the scales and play with them.
Okay, so you don't have to be musically inclined, folks. Just get out there and do your own little thing. Well,
everybody is musically inclined. We just have to let go of the belief system that tells us that we're not.
Okay. Well, we've been speaking with Will Johnson. He's the author of Cannabis and Spiritual Practice, The Ecstasy of Shiva, The Calm of Buddha. You can find it everywhere. Just go out and ask for it. If you don't find it, have the bookstore manager order it for you. So, Will, I thank you very much for being with me today as we go through this journey.
Yeah, you're really welcome. You're a lot of fun to do an interview like this, Monique. Thank you for everything.
Well, thank you, and thank you to the audience for being with us as we discover the spiritual practice using cannabis. The divine in me honors the divine in you, and when you're ready to live a bit of a different life, a better life, give me a call. Consultations that are 30 minutes or longer are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the radio show. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself. Pick up the phone, make that call, 888-240-6057, and remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of love. Abundant blessings, light, and love to all. Namaste.